I think this message would be one that I hope that you can come and see that this is what I believe and what I think is true. You know, back when the war and the Revolutionary War was over, there was a British general by the name of Lord Cornwallis, and at his surrender, he made a last-ditch effort to salvage his ego. He diverged the hidden agenda of the Edomite bloodlines by declaring to George Washington, and I'll give you the quote, quote, "A holy war will now begin on America. And when it is ended, America will be supposedly the citadel of freedom. But her millions will unknowingly be loyal subjects to the crown. Your blank will be used to teach the Jews religion." What do you think that word blank, what's the word in there? Your blank will be used to teach the Jews religion. Your churches. Your churches will be used to teach the Jews religion. And in less than 200 years, well, it's been 200 years since Cornwallis told Washington, the whole nation will be working for divine world government. I ask you, was he right or was he wrong? That government that they believe to be divine will be the British Empire. All religions will be permeated with Judaism without even being noticed by the masses. And they will be all under the invisible, all-seeing eye of the great architect of what's Freemasonry. That's from The Legions of Satan by Jonathan Williams. My question is, how did this happen? Here's how I believe it happened. It all started in a very dramatic way. In the early 1800s, late 1700s, the Restoration religion sprung up. There were also major changes in the doctrines and practices of the mainstream churches. It began with what's called the Second Great Awakening, which coincided with the Restoration Movement. It was like the water spigot was turned on, and the number of new churches kept being poured out. In fact, they still are. It began with the first four Restoration churches. Church of Christ, located down there, the Christian Church, and the Disciples of Christ, which are considered Christian by most other Christians, and the Church of Latter-day Saints, which is considered by many Christians not to be Christians. The first three were the result of the Second Great Awakening that occurred mainly in the states of Tennessee, Kentucky, and Ohio. One of the preachers actually lived for a short time in the town in which our church is located, right here in Burlington. Briefly, if you remember, the Second Great Awakening were large group meetings in which former Baptist and Methodist preachers held meetings with a diverse, large group of people for several days. Mainstream Christianity rejected many things about the awakening's practices. It considered heresy some of the doctrines that were preached and many of their practices that they did. But to put it bluntly, shortly after the ratification of the Constitution of the United States of America, from the depths of the netherworld came a mighty force of unclean, evil and demonic entities to seduce the covenant people of God. I'm going to say that again. Shortly after the ratification of the Constitution of the United States, from the depths of the netherworld came a mighty force of unclean, evil and demonic entities to seduce the covenant people of God. And let me tell you, they're still here. So powerful has been this onslaught that in just 200 years, Christianity has been reduced to a powerless, feminized state religion. Not only has Christianity's doctrines been altered, but the entire Western Christian culture has been turned upside down. Like numerous giant tidal waves, movement after movement has assailed themselves against the laws of America's God. I'll give you 28 movements. There's a lot more than that. The Restoration Movement, the Women's Suffrage Movement, the Temperance Movement, the Abortion Movement, the Abolition Movement, excuse me, the Feminist Movement, the Man Plan Mesmerizing Revival Movement, the End Time Movement, the Evolution Movement, the New Denominations Movement, the New Religions Movement, the Adoption of Catholic Holidays Movement, the Psychology Movement, the Dispensational Theology Movement, which included the Scofield Bible, the Incorporation Church Movement, the Federal Reserve and Income Tax Movement, the Abortion Movement, which included the Birth Control Movement, the Civil Rights Movement, the Integration Movement, the Democracy Movement, the Rock and Roll Music Revolution Movement, the Sexual Revolution Movement, the Drug Revolution Movement, the Pentecostal Movement, the Speaking in Tongues Movement, the Divine Healing Movement, the Charismatic Movement, the Church Growth Movement, and the Megachurch Movement. In 1980, there were nowhere near the present 30,000 denominations and various cults that masquerade as Christian churches in America. The major mainline non-Catholic churches, the Protestants, included the Episcopal Church, the Lutheran Church, the Presbyterian Church, the Congregational Church, the Baptist Church, and the Methodist Church. The Lutherans, the Presbyterians, the Congregational, and some Baptists were Calvinistic. The major mainline non-Protestant, non-Catholic churches included the Quaker Church, the Shakers, the Unitarian Church, and the Masonic Temples, and all four of those were Arminian. The Roman Catholic Church influences was limited to the two states of Maryland and Louisiana. The Eastern Catholic Church influence was basically nil. There were some remnant covenant churches, neither Protestant nor Catholic in America, very, very few. The first area change was centered in the area from Maysville, Kentucky to Knoxville, Tennessee. Parts of North Carolina and Ohio also participated in the first major movement of the 19th century. It's known as the Restoration Movement. Kentucky became a commonwealth in the year 1792. Tennessee became a state in 1796, and Ohio, 1803. The city of Lexington, Kentucky, had a population of fewer than 1,800 people. The land of Daniel Boone and Thomas Walker was filled with individualistic, rugged, isolated pioneers who lived a dangerous, difficult life. With the constant threat of attack from savage Indians to the rigors of daily living, the backwoodsmen were basically uneducated and separated from any churches. And the churches that were on the eastern side of the Appalachian Mountains had no longer an appeal to this new breed of American who had migrated into the western side. Formal intellectual sermons with strict ritualistic services were the last thing the whiskey-drinking farmers wanted to sit through. Thus, the time was right for a new brand of Christianity to make its appearance. And what appearance it made. Sudden and dramatic. While widespread revivals were absent between 1745 and 1795, local awakenings kept the revival flame from completely dying out. But in 1796, that's just a few years after our Constitution was ratified, the embers were once again ignited in the hills of North Carolina. The open communal service, a tradition that was brought from Scotland by the Presbyterians, began to be practiced in America. Pastor James McGreedy organized some of the first. It soon spread to Logan County, Kentucky, and several other locations near the border of Kentucky and Tennessee when Pastor McGreedy moved to Logan County, Kentucky in the year 1798. Logan County was one of the roughest counties, if not the roughest in all the state. And I'll give you a quote. The trouble was that no one on the frontier was designated to enforce the law. With the result, the Congress would state, the immunity which offenders experienced attracts as to an asylum the most vile and abandoned criminals, and all the same time deters useful and virtuous persons from making settlements in such a society. Unquote. That's from the Great Revivals and the Great Republic. I'll give you another quote. Logan County attracted so many murderers, horse thieves, highway robbers, and counterfeiters that it was nicknamed Rouge's Harbor by those outlaws who fled there to escape justice back east. But within a year, revival began to break out. That's from the book From Sea to Shining Sea by Peter Marshall. First, it happened in the quarterly command service at the Red River Congregation. Then the following month, they celebrated the Lord's Supper at the Gasper River Church. A year later at Red River, then at Muddy River, then back to Gasper River Church again with similar results. What happened to these profane swearers, murderers, robbers, drunks at these communal services defied logic? As recorded by William Chandler in the above quoted book, Pastor Byron W. Stone, a Presbyterian pastor from Bourbon County, Kentucky, expressed what he saw at one of these meetings. And I'm giving you a quote. There on the edge of a prairie in Logan County, Kentucky, the multitudes came together and continued a number of days and nights encamped on the ground, during which time the worship was carried on in some part of the encampment. The scene was new to me and passing strange. It baffled description. Many, very many, fell down as men slain in battle and continued for hours together in apparently breathless and motionless state, sometimes for a few minutes reviving and exhibiting symptoms of life by a deep groan or by a piercing shriek or by a prayer for mercy fervently uttered. After lying there for hours, they obtained deliverance. The gloomy crowd that had covered their faces seemed gradually and visibly to disappear, and hope and smile brightened into joy. They would rise, shouting deliverance, and then would address the surrounding multitude in language truly eloquent and impressive. With astonishment did I hear men, women, and children declaring the wonderful works of God and the glorious mystery of the gospel, unquote. Things were happening at McGreedy's meetings that had not happened anywhere in America at any church meeting since the end of the First Great Awakening. Word of mouth spread as to what was happening throughout Kentucky and the adjacent states. Since there were so few churches and fewer pastors, Presbyterians, Baptists, and Methodists continued to combine their churches in these special outdoor meetings. Besides their church members, the settlers, including both black freemen and slaves, also attended. The attendees arrived in wagons, by horses, by donkeys, and by foot. Thousands came from over 100 miles away, and they stayed for several days at a time. Music, preaching, praying with extraordinary enthusiasm and excitement soon gave way to something very strange. It came to a climax at Cane Ridge, Kentucky. I will interject. About 4 or 5 years ago, Rand and I, we went to Cane Ridge, Kentucky, and we saw where it took place, and we took pictures. And I actually spit on his grave. Because here's the quote. Arguably, the most important religious gathering in all of American history took place at Cane Ridge, Kentucky. That's according to Vanderbilt University historian Paul Coughlin. Pastor Barton W. Stone of the Cane Ridge Presbyterian Church, after attending several of James McGreedy's revivals, he decided to host one himself at his church at Cane Ridge. But what happened there even startled him. Approximately 30,000 people traveling hundreds of miles came to the campground meeting. 30,000 people. How many people were in Lexington at this time? 1,800. 30,000 people came. They stayed from Friday to the next Thursday. Continuous preaching, prayers, shouting and singing took place with quote unquote godly hysteria. So you might have a Methodist preacher preaching from over tree stump. You might have the Presbyterian preaching in the church. You might have a Baptist preaching at the other side of the field. And you might have other people getting up and saying their hallelujahs. Bodily exercises such as drooping, jerking, barking, falling to the ground motionless for hours, uncontrollable weeping, uncontrollable laughing, hugging, kissing, clapping of hands, seeing visions, talking to the distressed, talking to one another, even talking to opposers of the meeting, singing, shouting, rolling on the ground. That's where you got holy rollers. Rolling on the ground, falling into trances, groans, babble of speech, loud prayers, impassionate preaching, and the singing of hymns that had the music with the beat of the voodoo drums. Needless to say, the mainline denominations were shocked and angered at what was happening at these services, but even more so at the decadence that was occurring at many locations in the campground. Drunkenness and disorderly conduct, including sexual intimacies, degenerated into that of a mini Mardi Gras. It was a common saying that at Cane Ridge, quote, more souls were begot than saved, unquote. This week-long ecumenical, multicultural, interracial, festive campground meeting cracked the foundation of Christian theology and Christian culture in America. Esteem for Jesus, expositional preaching, essential Christian doctrine, and the practice of church discipline and sanctification of the Holy Communion were quickly thrown away in the land west of the Appalachian Mountains. Some believe that what happened at Pastor McGreedy's meetings and at similar ones like at Cane Ridge had not happened since the Book of Acts. But was that really true? Did those in the temple courtyard on the day of Pentecost and those at Cornelius' house when Peter visited bark like a dog when they were converted? Were they slain in the spirit? Were they laughing uncontrollably? Did drunkards replace the apostles and do some preaching? Were there immoral sexual behavior going on nearby? Maybe what happened during the Second Great Awakening was a counterfeit revival. The leadership in the mainstream Presbyterian church thought the meetings were unscriptural, and as a result, that denomination was soon thereafter split into two. Calvinism gave way to Arminianism in the frontier states. Church structure, order, and sacraments became a thing of the past. But the Methodist and Baptist churches adapted to the new gospel and grew exponentially for several decades as they installed circuit rider preachers and continued campground meetings. The Lutheran and Episcopal churches had little influence in the West. Their intellectual sermons and common prayer book services were no match for the more entertaining, socializing, unstructured emotional services of the Baptist, Methodist, and Arminian Presbyterians. The second area. While the effects of the Second Great Awakening were spreading throughout the frontier from Ohio to Tennessee, another outbreak of demonic activity occurred in the frontier area of Upper New York State. Along the newly built Erie Canal, settlers had flocked from their coastal homes. This set the stage for another stage of America's turning from its roots of essential Christian doctrine. Again, it was from the ranks of the Presbyterian Church that apostasy sprang. After a visit from an evil spirit, the life of Charles Grandison Finney was dramatically and suddenly changed in the year 1821. Within a decade, he became a leader of the Arminian Presbyterians and the Arminian Congregational Church, which taught against the Westminster Confession of Faith of the Presbyterians that had ordained him. In fact, Finney became the leader in the movement that promoted abolition and interracial and intergender higher education. From the students at both Lane Seminary in Cincinnati and Oberlin College outside of Cleveland, Ohio, they led the way to agitate the nation to its most disastrous war of history. The trend to socialize gospel and mesmerizing techniques had taken root in a new kind of Christianity, a false Christianity, but an increasing popular one. With Finney and Joseph Smith and the disciples in the North, with Barton Stone, Alexander and Thomas Campbell, Walter Scott, Sidney Rigdon, James McGreedy in the Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee areas, the face of Christianity was being quickly distorted, and with it, the direction of America. Now I will go half a world away to the country of South Africa. While evangelist Finney was being supported by the Tappan brothers for the promotion of their abolition agenda, the Church of England promoted a similar agenda in the Cape Colony of South Africa. The British government instituted in 1835 radical legislation known as Ordinance 50. It was directed against the immigrants who had come to Cape Colony from France, Germany, and the Netherlands, known as the Afrikaners, many years earlier. These former Europeans and slaves had cultivated and farmed the land inward from the Cape. But these new laws were directed against the laws of the Afrikaners' God. The new civil rights legislation from England demanded seven things. One, all policies of racial segregation were to be banned. Two, all Negroes were given full citizenship to vote. Three, severe taxes were imposed. Four, prohibition of the Afrikaners' native language. Five, insane stipulation that any repeal or amendment could only be done in England. Six, no retaliation was permitted to be taken against any Negro who raped, looted, or murdered whites. And the seventh, with the support of Anglican missionaries, interracial marriages and interracial schools were advocated. To prove their godliness, many Anglican missionaries married Negro women and paraded children of both races under the banner of, quote, "We are of one blood," unquote. That should sound very, very similar. It's exactly the same as answers in Genesis and the majority of so-called Christian groups advocate today. As a result, with a population less than half of the attendees at the Cambridge Revival, the Afrikaners abandoned their homes and businesses to make a dangerous trek many miles by wagons to an uninhabited wilderness far to the northwest, away from the jurisdiction of the British. Their faithfulness to the laws of God was vindicated with the astonishing intervention of God at the Battle of Blood River that preserved the 465 Afrikaners from total annihilation from the 30,000 Zulu warriors. This ensured that there would be a Christian nation in southern Africa for the next century and a half. On December 16th, 1838, the Afrikaners defeated the Zulus. It's one of the few bright spots in a time of great darkness in Christianity. As the Afrikaners began to keep the vow that they had made with their God, we will look at another strange development that happened across the world and the deteriorating Christianity in America. Orson Hyde was born in Connecticut in January 1805. He was raised by neighbors who took him to Ohio, where he came under the influence at the age of 26 of a former Baptist preacher turned Campbellite preacher turned Mormon preacher, Sidney Rigdon. After filling several Mormon missions and participating in Zion's camp, in 1835 he was ordained an apostle. He crossed the Atlantic in 1837 with Heber C. Kimball to start the Latter-day Saints British mission, which later produced many Utah immigrants. One of significance now was the family of presidential candidate Mitt Romney. Miles Romney and Elizabeth Gaskell were married in England in the year 1830. In 1837, Miles and Elizabeth were on their way to the market when they saw a group of people assembled on a street corner. They were curious as to what attracted the crowd. They discovered that it was American preacher Orson Hyde, a Mormon apostle. The church was how old now? 7 years old. To whom they listened and they were converted. In September 1839, they were baptized, and they left England in 1841 and gathered with the saints in Nauvoo, Illinois. But in the year of the miraculous Afrikaner victory over the Zulus that set the Afrikaners on the right track in South Africa, Orson Hyde, in 1838, was excommunicated from the Mormon Church. Orson's boldness and energy frequently made him the subject of criticism from his superiors. But in the year 1839, after making sincere reconciliation, he was reinstated. Orson served for 43 years as a Mormon apostle, 28 years of which he was president of the Quorum of the Twelve. In addition to his literary contributions, he was a farmer, a supervisor of Utah immigration, a wagon train master, irrigation specialist, founder of new Utah settlements, a railroad planner, a sawmill operator, a participant in the Utah War Councils, a regent of the University of Deseret, a legislature, newspaper editor, Indian fighter, peacemaker, lawyer, judge, and statesman. Few Mormons can exceed his list of accomplishments. While the Afrikaners were establishing their new freedom, Orson Hyde, a descendant of Esau, carried out the longest and perhaps the most dangerous mission performed by an early Mormon elder. It was just 11 years since the beginning of the Mormon Church. Orson Hyde made a solo mission to where? Where do you think he went? Jerusalem. Why did he go there? Remember, it was just 11 years since the Mormon Church began. He dedicated the land of Palestine for the return of the Jews. We'll come back to Orson Hyde's mission to Jerusalem later in the sermon. But first, I want to talk about William Morgan, who was murdered by the Masons after his mysterious disappearance from the Cannonalia jail in 1826. He later became one of the first to receive by proxy the new Mormon rite of baptism for the dead in the year 1841. How this came to be is really quite an interesting story. William Morgan left behind a widow whose name was Lucinda Morgan, a petite blue-eyed blonde and two small children. His widow was 25 years of age. Just as her husband's death became a symbol of the evils of Masonry that became the catalyst of a political movement, Lucinda rapidly became a living reminder of her evils of a craft that would leave a young woman a widow in the bloom of her maidenhood. What is not known by the masses is that Joseph Smith and William Morgan were both members of the same Masonic lodge. William's widow was sure that her husband had been a victim of foul play and fully supported the anti-Masonic movement. In October 1827, a corpse was discovered on the shore of Lake Ontario, which some speculate might have been Captain Bill Morgan's body. Lucinda examined the body and testified that she was certain that it was her husband. But a Canadian woman, possibly at Masonic instigation, claimed that it was her son. The body was buried in Canada, but the mystery surrounding the affair was never fully cleared up. When the Mormon Church was organized with six men as members in the year 1830, Lucinda Morgan decided to remarry. She married a Batavia silversmith, George W. Harris, who was 21 years her elder. 4 years later, in the year 1834, the Harrises were living in Terre Haute, Indiana. In the fall of 1834, the apostle Orson Pratt stopped at Terre Haute and proclaimed to any who would listen his perverted gospel of Mormonism. George and Lucinda Harris did and became Mormons. By the fall of 1837, George and Lucinda Harris were already residing among the saints in far west Missouri. About that time, Joseph Smith and his counselor, Sidney Rigdon, came for a visit. They stayed at the home of the Harrises. Joseph Smith soon had convinced Lucinda Harris to become one of his 33 wives. She was a plural wife to him for about 7 years until he was murdered. When they moved to Nauvoo, they lived right across the street from Joseph Smith. 12 years later, 1856, George W. Harris charged his wife with willfully deserting him. The divorce was uncontested. In the year 1860, George W. Harris was excommunicated from the Mormon Church and died in a state of apostasy later that year after almost 30 years in the Mormon Church he helped to build. Lucinda Morgan was living in Memphis, Tennessee. She joined the Catholic Sisters of Charity and worked with the Leah Asylum of Memphis. She died in obscurity. Thus ends the fascinating story of the woman who at one time was the public image of anti-Masonry, the widow of William Morgan. And I will say that the nation was very anti-Mason at that time. In fact, they had the third party and ran a candidate for president of the United States. Now back to Orson Hyde and his mission to Palestine from April 1841. To December 1842, he recorded that before dawn on October 24th, 1841, he climbed up the Mount of Olives, overlooking the city, then both wrote and recited a prayer which he had received in a vision while he was living in America, part of which reads as follows. Now, O Lord, thy servant has been obedient to the heavenly vision which thou gavest him in his native land. And under the shadow of thine outstretched arm, he has safely arrived in this place to dedicate and consecrate this land unto thee. For the gathering together of Judas, not any of the other tribes of Israel, but to Judah's scattered remnants, according to the predictions of the holy prophets. For the building up of Jerusalem again, as it has been trodden down by the Gentiles so long. Now I'm going to read you something I think you might have heard before. And for the rearing a temple in honor of thy name. Everlasting thanks be ascribed unto thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that thou hast preserved thy servant from the dangers of the seas and from the plague and pestilence which they have ceased the land to mourn. The violence of man has also been restrained, and thy providential care by night and by day has been exercised over thine unworthy servant. Accept, therefore, O Lord, the tribute of a grateful heart for all past favors, and be pleased to continue thy kindness and mercy towards a needy worm of the dust, unquote. The prayer goes on, but that's enough. Having dedicated Jerusalem and Palestine for the ingathering of the Jews and the rebuilding of Solomon's temple, Hyde departed the mountain after building a small altar with stones. Now, in the year 1972, the Mormon Church explored the possibility of erecting a memorial to Orson Hyde on the Mount of Olives. After several years of extensive negotiations, the Jews offered a parcel of land on the Mount of Olives for the development of a park. Funds were raised. And on October 24th, 1979, the park was dedicated in the presence of Latter-day Saint leaders, Israelite dignitaries, and Arab notables. The park, with its panoramic view, amphitheater, winding walks, and gardens, is a fitting tribute to Elder Hyde and an appropriate gift to the city of Jerusalem. It's a place of quiet meditation for the apostate Christian, Muslim, and Jews to enjoy alike. It's no coincidence that historical annals point to the 1840s as a period of awakening among Jews dispersed throughout the world. Out of this new dawn arose men of influence like Moses Hess, Joseph Salvador, Moses Montefiore, Leo Pinsky, and Theodore Herzl. Having been touched by the spirit of gathering, they began to instill in Jews everywhere the desire to return to their ancient homeland. It has grown into now a movement to where in 1948, they stole the land of Palestine and made it a Zionist state. Mormon apostle Orson Hyde established Zionism by means of a highly occultic dedicatory prayer circle conducted at the very Mount of Olives where Jesus Christ walked, dedicated all of Lucifer's holy Melchizedek priesthood, power, and authority to have the Babylonian seed of Cain control the entire Middle East by means of their satanic conjuring. The Mormons look forward to the day when Muslim, Christian, and Jew resolve their differences and be united. That is an absolutely impossible situation. Christianity is a unique religion. It's based on the covenant that God made with a certain family. The descendants of Cain and Esau have tried to destroy Israel. And the descendants of Ishmael have been at war with Israel for centuries. God has told his people they will never be destroyed because he has made an unconditional covenant with them. My conclusion. What a time in history. The Mormon Church has grown at a fast rate. They went from New York to Ohio to Missouri to Illinois and to Utah. They have been run out of New York for the sin of fortune-telling and other con-related activities in the family of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. Ohio for a failed, bankrupt, fraudulent bank. Missouri for armed battles between the militia of the state of Missouri against the Mormons over slavery and plural marriages. And Illinois over corruption of the leadership of the Mormon Church and its Masonic doctrines and plural marriages. In spite of all this unchristian activities, the Mormon Church insisted that the kingdom of God was the Mormon Church. They experienced rapid growth from all over the world. In just 14 years from the Mormon Church beginning, Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon was running for the president and vice president of the United States with a great opportunity to win. The demonic and evil spirits were influencing many individuals who were striking Christianity down to a meaningless power in the world. Jews, descendants of Esau, were from the beginning taking a major role in the Mormon Church. Early Mormonism was based on magic and witchcraft. When the Afrikaners won their amazing victory, the Mormon apostle was in a few years in Palestine, proclaiming what an evil spirit had told him in a vision. Did you notice when Orson High said, quote, "For the gathering together of Judah's scattered remnants," unquote? It was just the remnant of the tribe of Judah. This is very common in the Zionist movement. Judah was just one of the 13 tribes of Israel. Orson Hyde incorrectly called the descendants of Judah Jews. But what did he call the other 12 tribes? He didn't call them Jews. He called them Gentiles. The covenant that God made and swore to Israel was to all the tribes, not just one tribe. They are called Hebrews, not Jews. They are called Semites, not Jews. They are called Israelites, not Jews. And now I'm going to give you a quote from Pastor Ramsey. Quote, "If there is one primary reason for the failure of America, it is the failure of the ministers of God to hold forth the truth in their words and their lives." Do you remember what Cornwallis said? Who was going to bring in the New World Order? It was the churches. America's pulpits are dominated by men who know not the God of the Bible, the God of Israel. And they preach a God and a Jesus that is tepid, helpless, and dependent on the will of the people for the accomplishment of his great redemptive goals. Many of the pulpits are filled with men whose lives are riddled with the sin of adultery, fornication, drunkenness, lasciviousness, and ungodliness. Many pulpits are filled with women who cannot be called nor qualified by Bible standards to lead the church of Jesus Christ. Many churches sin against God because they allow deacons and uncalled and unordained elders to lead the church instead of God-called and God-ordained and God-anointed pastors to lead the church. Most of America's pulpits do not teach the people the difference between the profane and the holy. Churches have become cathedrals filled with entertainment and preaching a psychologically uplifting messages without a confrontation of sin, a call to repentance, or a warning of judgment. Baptisms and memberships are increased with no impact on society, no change in lifestyle, and a worsening degradation of America's Christian culture, increased violence and greed, and an open sex society would make Sodom and Gomorrah blush. When judgment comes, the people who have been preaching milk toast and love by their pastors will curse their pastors, cast them out, and seek someone who knows God. But it may be too late to stop the judgment. God has a remnant, but most of them are not in the churches of today. Among them, he will find a man who will raise him as a prophet of God, and God will find a man among them who he can raise up to lead his people. But before that time comes, God will have to chasten and pass his people under the rod, separating them from the love of the world. I believe the time is soon, and my prayer is, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done," unquote. Blessed be the Lord God of Israel.